why does Kappa not have to get a haircut and Mace does? Is just Chris Evans too handsome to have long hair and that's why they had to have him cut it? But, like, I don't get it. The Cap's just like, oh, Mace, get a haircut. What the fuck? This other guy's got hair? What's up? This is Movies On Up. If you like Scary Movie, who gives a damn? Someone we all give a damn about is my co-host seated right across from me, Mr. Dave Bacella.
Not another co-host.
Not just another co-host. He's my co-host. That's Mr. Dave. I am Ryan. We are Movies On Up. If you like Scary Movie, who gives a damn is not just a little shade kicked at Scary Movie, but it is also a tagline. If you can figure out what movie that tagline belongs to, and it is not Scary Movie, send your guess to us in one of the following ways. You can email us, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can put your guess on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/moviesonup, or you can tweet at us at moviesonup on the Twitter. If you choose correctly, and we choose you, you will win not just another prize package, you'll win a Movies On Up prize package full of all sorts of great things.
To brighten your day.
Yes. We hope to brighten your day today with a discussion about, I don't want to call it an Alex Garland movie because it's a movie that Alex Garland wrote, directed by Danny Boyle. We're doing that because Alex Garland is directing his own writing this week in Annihilation. But we went back to a movie that he just wrote, which happens to be one of Dave's favorites of all time, and that is Sunshine. We've talked a little bit about the movie, but for it being as loved by Dave, and I like it a lot too.
It's a top three movie ever for me.
Do Alex Garland and Danny Boyle have
two top three movies ever? Yeah.
Okay. We did a 28 Days and a 28 Weeks episode a while back, but we really haven't given Sunshine its due. All that's going to change today when we're just going to really...
I feel like it didn't make the culture...
Relevance,
it
did, yeah.
Yeah, it's not as big of a movie as 28 Days Later was. I think people are familiar with that movie.
Does not have a sequel.
I feel like Sunshine is more of a lesser movie, like not as widely seen.
Hot take. I think it's a better movie.
That's tough. Like, that's a toss-up. That's why I say top three favorite movie, because of of my three favorites, like, I don't know that I can place them. I would think it... I could see that argument. I could see it overall better, and I can't argue it.
I'm not going to try.
I could argue both ways. Yes. Like, I really could.
I'm not going to try and make the argument today.
It's like
that
asking
it is better,
me to pick one, who my favorite kid is. Well, like, it's going to be a different answer every day.
Depending on which one of them is standing right in front of you.
Yeah.
And which one of them is asking you. Sunshine came out way back in 2007. It starred Cillian Murphy, no surprise there, Chris Evans, Rose Byrne. It earned $242,000 on its opening weekend, which was July 20th of 2007. That was good for 25th place. You may remember July 20th, 2007 is the weekend I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry debuted at number one with $34.2 million, followed by Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, Hairspray, Transformers, and Ratatouille. Sunshine went on to gross $3.675 million domestically. Although, as a sidebar, it did make $28 million overseas, so much more successful over there. Its haul of $3.6 million sits it at 5,923rd place on the all-time domestic list, one spot below a 1984 movie that I honestly cannot even give you a clue to guess what it is.
Ice Pirates?
No. It is John Sayles' The Brother from Another Planet. Do either of those things ring any bells for you?
No.
Me either. So this is probably the first time we've ever done a movie list where I was like, I absolutely have never even heard of this film. So that gives
John Sayles I'm familiar with, but not
yeah, but certainly not The Brother from Another Planet. It is one spot above David Lynch's 1997 identity switch movie starring Bill Pullman.
What is that called? Mulholland?
Nope, not Mulholland Drive. Although Drive, Road. What's another name for a road?
I forget.
Lost Highway.
That's it, Lost
yep,
Highway.
Yep, I knew
yeah,
you were
right
as soon as I said
it.
Yeah. For more context and fun, we're way in the doldrums here in 59, almost the 6,000s. But Sunshine sits 7 spots above a movie you may be familiar with, for good or bad, Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream. And it's 3 spots below Alexander Aja's High Tension, which is a movie we talk an awful lot about. And it's 14 spots below Jeff Nichols' 2006 movie Midnight Special. So roundabout in this 5,900 range, you've got Danny Boyle, David Lynch, Darren Aronofsky, Alexander Aja.
And John Sayles.
And John Sayles. Some really culty movies in there. I think certainly Requiem, High Tension, they have a giant cult following. Maybe not as much for Midnight Special, but Jeff Nichols is a really solid director. But sometimes great directors make great movies that not a lot of people see. And I think Sunshine certainly illustrates that point. This was the second of the Danny Boyle, Alex Garland team-ups, coming just 4 years after the first one, which was 28 days later. They also represent the first 2 features Garland wrote, which is a pretty impressive start.
The Beach and the Tesseract were movies based on his novels, but his first screenwriting credit is 28 days later. His second is Sunshine, and then he followed that up with Never Let Me Go, which was great, and Dread, which was awesome.
Which is entertaining.
Yeah, and then he went into Ex Machina, which that was his directorial debut, and then now he's adapting Annihilation from the novel, but not a massive filmography yet.
No, certainly not, but yeah.
I'll take quality over quantity.
Right. I mean, Ex Machina was a really, really well-written
movie.
And
so
as
much.
Far as, for a while, that was probably going to be the movie that we did this week because it was him directing, which is more akin to what he's doing this week. But I think Ex Machina being a little bit newer and more successful from a box office standpoint than Sunshine was, I think we wanted to kind of dig into maybe one that people aren't necessarily as familiar with.
And the thing with Sunshine is, like, I always talk about it being one of my favorites, and it used to be a point where I would watch it at least once a month. I hadn't watched it in a few years, and leading up to doing this episode, I thought, do I just go into it with what I remember? I've seen it so many times, I would be okay not rewatching it, or do I just rewatch it and see if it still has that power or if it's lost anything? It hasn't lost. I watched it 3 times. Like, we were gonna record last week and last Thursday, and I decided to watch it Thursday. Today's Tuesday. I've watched it 3 times from Thursday to Tuesday, just because, like, I forgot how much I loved watching it.
Some of them, you have that inner wrestling match with yourself. Like, you know what? I've seen this movie already. Do I really want to go back and watch it? Sunshine was like, absolutely. We watched The Rise of Cobra for this podcast. Like, you think I'm not going to watch Sunshine? Absolutely. That was not a hard thing to do at all. In 2007, to kind of rewind a little bit, Boyle and Garland had already had a pretty massive hit with 28 Days Later. Maybe massive is not exactly the word for it, but it was certainly a hit. And it was a hit in the States as well. And Boyle had had that indie smash with Trainspotting that he did a decade before in 96. But if you look at Sunshine in 2007, it came out in the summer. By the summer of 2008, he was Academy Award winner, Danny Boyle. So that's how quickly his career really turned from making a movie that is almost in 6,000th place on the domestic charts to accepting the Golden Statuette for Slumdog months later, 6, 7, 8 months later.
And I mean, I was high on Danny Boyle at the time, and 28 Days Later, obviously, I had liked Trainspotting, A Life Less Ordinary, I loved, and like, these are movies I had seen before 28 Days Later. Millions was between 28 Days Later and Sunshine, which I adore that movie. That kicked off Slumdog, and then 127 Hours, and those are, then all of a sudden, like, oh, Danny Boyle's an Oscar movie maker now. And he did Trance in between Steve Jobs to get back into that, but I love Danny Boyle as a director. Like, he's one of my favorite directors. He's one that I will watch anything he does.
One of the things I think that is fantastic about these two guys, specifically from Garland as a storyteller and Boyle directing those stories, is that they have, certainly, they're able to give you their take on the genre. And it is not a fanciful take. It's very grounded. I mean, it's almost like you don't have to suspend that much disbelief to get in their world. The barriers to entry are pretty low. They're not asking you to believe that in fairies or anything. It's like, listen, here's a very a somewhat plausible situation, and then they give you a great movie that grows out of that.
I mean, 28 Days Later, it's quote-unquote zombie movie, but it's an infection movie,
yes.
And it sets up where the infection comes from, and it's believable. It sets up this world. It sucks you into this world. Sunshine, the sun is dying, and the sun dies, we all die. So, you know, that's your setup. Here's a spaceship. It's the second attempt to try to drop a nuclear bomb into the sun to try to reignite it. Which, yeah, that's sciency, but it's believable. Sure, I'm not Neil deGrasse Tyson, but that sounds logical to me.
Even from a, you know, a space mission standpoint, or to go back to 28 Days Later, you know, we've seen plenty of examples of infected movie where, you know, the undead are always kind of that chief danger. 28 Days Later, it's not really the case. It's as much when Doctor Who shows up with his band of a-holes, like, they're actually the villains in the movie. And then when you see Sunshine, where you mentioned it, it's a space mission where we meet all the crew, and Harvey, even when they go to Icarus One, he mentions, okay, this is about the time we're all going to be murdered by an alien. Of course, that's sort of the trope with the genre, so much so that they make a joke about it in the movie, and it doesn't happen. But even when it does, it's done very much in their way.
Yeah, Garland's script is so good. And this is a weird comparison, but from a screenwriting standpoint, this is very similar structure-wise to an Edgar Wright script. Edgar Wright is very foreshadowy in the most subtle of ways. And this movie is very foreshadowy in the most subtle of ways. That there's stuff that, you know, I've seen this movie over 100 times, probably, not exaggerating, and I still pick up new stuff. Like, first shot of Mace, is he's putting his hand in the cold water. Mm-hmm. You know, the first shot of Cliff Curtis is him staring at the sun and, like, how much can I see? And stuff like that that comes back later. There's plenty of talk about what happened to Icarus One, and there's a lot of foreshadowing that you don't really catch. Like, even when it comes to fruition, like, you don't realize it until you watch it again. And it's very masterful in that way. And all the characters are done well. And we often talk about, like, I'll take quality of death over body count anytime. So, I mean, you only have your handful of characters, but every death matters. And that's how it should be in these bottle type movies. And you have a crew of 7 or 8, you need to get to know all of them so that when they do start dying, it matters. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the least developed was the captain, and he's the first to go.
Right.
But you get his line of command. You understand. Like, he's the one that needs the least because you understand his importance without being told it. So it does so good of you get to know every character. And there's, yeah, okay, I want Harvey to die. He's the Miguel Ferrera character from Deep Star Six. So, like, yeah, I'm ready for him to die. I'm waiting for it. But then the others, it's like, oh, I like Michelle Yeoh. She just likes her plants. I don't want to see her die. Like, it's so well done.
When you talk about the foreshadow, even with Kaneda's death, as soon as he tells you who second in command is, you're pretty much like, well, that's going to probably play a factor here pretty quickly, and certainly it does. He's a bit like the red shirt where, oh, this is a Danny Boyle movie. Cillian Murphy and this other guy are going out to try and not get fried by the sun. I wonder which guy is. And certainly enough, it was the minority, so there you go. One of the things, you know, we talk about this movie being grounded and not being a physicist. Neither Dave and I are a physicist. We're part-time movie podcast hosts. I think that kind of disqualifies us from any kind of higher education. So I don't know the physics of this mission. But I think if you can buy that, like, the sun shrinks and loses energy, and if that's how the sun is going to die and not that it's actually going to expand and incinerate the Earth first, making this all a moot point. But if that happens, if the sun loses energy, then you can kind of see where, all right, well, the sun's a giant nuclear reactor, so maybe we can drop a bomb in it. All that works. And then what they're able to do is for the payload. It has to be so big. We've used up all of our earthly resources on this second attempt. So then now you know that, you know, the stakes aren't necessarily just the people, or certainly not the people on Icarus 2. They weren't even the people on Icarus 1. It's the entire Earth. So if you're watching Alien, as much as I love that, boy, I hope that and the cat are able to make it off the ship.
Stakes are on that ship.
Right. Even in 28 Days Later, again, we're talking about a director and the work of a specific writer, but even the stakes of that movie, this outbreak, if it doesn't stay contained, which, spoiler alert, it does not, you know, we're talking about world-threatening events, but it's plausible. You can understand how those stakes organically get to that point.
Yeah, and I like that in 28 Days Later, where he's in the locked up, and he's like, in other places, they're watching The Simpsons, and like, this isn't happening. And then that all comes back when he sees the plane flying over, and it's like, oh, maybe it is just us. Mm-hmm. And I like the stakes in this movie, because it is, you tried it once before, it didn't work. They don't know why. So these people went on this mission. Pretty much all of them but Harvey know that chances are you're not going back. Yeah, you're set up to go back, but chances are you're not getting there. And I feel like everybody has accepted that except Harvey. Even before stuff goes wrong, I feel like they all went on this mission with that in mind, except him.
Yeah, knowing that the first mission didn't come back.
And
so
they don't know why.
Right. Whatever happened to them, there's a good probability it could happen to Icarus 2. And I think what happened to Icarus 1, when we find out that it is Pinbacker, played by a completely unrecognizable Mark Strong, he's sort of happening again. I think the movie does certainly take a turn there from being a very like straight sci-fi movie to now a movie that's a bit closer to horror.
It does take a shift from a bottle sci-fi movie into what's essentially a slasher movie. Just like 28 Days Later took a turn from like, oh, the zombies are the evil that we need to survive. Right. And now, no, we have to survive the humans. They're the bigger threat. They're the ones that are cognizant of what they're doing. The sun doesn't know what it's doing, but Pinbacker does. And Pinbacker's playing God. Christopher Eccleston in 28 Days Later, they were playing God. Hey, we have to build the world over again. Like, they're trying to create the world how they feel they need to create it. And, you know, here's Pinbacker, who now he is the real threat. It's no longer just the sun and the mission. It's now we have Pinbacker, who derailed one mission, and he's going to try to do the second one.
You mentioned the aspect of playing God. I mean, obviously, this guy's, from being so close to the sun, he's kind of gone around the bend with really worshiping this thing as a deity. But, you know, also, like, he kind of brings the point of, okay, we probably can actually restart the sun, but is that something that we ought to be doing? As humans, should we try to influence cosmic events? Science says we have the power to do it, so yeah, why not? Maybe religion says that it's kind of the will of the force, and so you have Pinbacker asserting himself as like the arbiter of God that's like, oh, no. He wants us to die, so I'm going to make sure that this mission kind of fails again. But it brings, I think, some of the folks, and it's a relatively small community, that have seen this movie and have some problems with it. I think a lot of those problems come when it stops being, you know, like Star Trek, basically, and turns into the really shitty Alien.
Yeah, I brought this movie up a lot with The Last Jedi and what I consider like the Sunshine Theory, because if you take Pinbacker out of this movie and you just continue with them surviving and trying to, they get to Icarus 1, nothing's there, so they're trying to get back on course. And it's a standard sci-fi flick. What separates? It's probably good. The characters are good. It's written well. But what separates it? It's a standard, straight from point A to point B. It's predictable. And people would complain that, like, oh, it's, you know, there's nothing special about it. There's nothing memorable. It's pretty straightforward. So you veer and you take a turn that you don't see coming. You don't go into this movie expecting it to turn into a horror movie. And people are pissed that it takes that turn. And I feel like that was the big thing with The Last Jedi, is that it didn't give you everything you expected. So it was bad because it took these turns that you don't expect. But yet Force Awakens gave you everything you wanted in The Last Jedi, but it was bad because it was too predictable. This movie of all of them, I think, is the best example of that, to where you either go straight forward and you're just a sci-fi movie, or you take a turn and you turn into something else that has its own identity.
It certainly does take a turn, and I think Pinbacker is like the easy character or event to point to. Okay, this is where the movie really kind of breaks course. But it also, I think, becomes more like theoretical at that point. The idea of space and time, really, as you get closer to the sun and gravity plays a larger role, like the whole movie does not necessarily become linear at that point. There's a lot of great visuals in this movie. One of my favorite is right after Kappa detonates the payload, And he's kind of caught betwixt and between the nuclear power that man has created and the nuclear power that has been in the solar system since Jesus put it there or since a space slug sneezed and put it there, whatever you want to say. I love that imagery, and you see it at various points throughout the movie. You mentioned Michelle Yeoh. You see her in that oxygen garden where it's blowing up all around her and there's light and there's heat, but it's being controlled, so she's safe from it, much in the same way Kappa is. And then when you look in the observation room, there's sort of the iris there that's protecting humanity. So that juxtaposition between the light and the heat in space causing the death of a lot of our characters, with the people that are on Earth that have no light and have no heat, and that's why they're dying. I like the idea of there's so much of it here, yet we just can't seem to get it where it needs to be. And man doesn't really have dominion over that kind of stuff. I think the imagery there is just really fantastic stuff from Boyle. And when they get into the payload itself and everything's very geometrically shaped, then things, I think, go a little bit more off the rails. And up until that point, it was a very A to B science fiction movie that I think everybody could understand. And then it gets into almost like 2001. And I think that's where they lose some people.
Danny Boyle is one of my favorite visual directors. 28 Days Later is a beautiful movie for a quote-unquote zombie movie. It's beautiful. There are some shots in there that I just think about randomly. The colors and the use of the blues and everything, and just some of the landscape that he shoots. He's very visual. And you had the British countryside to do that. So to be on a spaceship and still be able to deliver a pretty visual movie, I thought was cool. And some of the shots, like, there's cool visuals, even though he is contained. Like with Harvey, as Harvey's floating away, and the shot of his eyes as his face freezes over, like, that's cool. That's something a little different. It'd be easy just to show a body floating away, but, like, Danny Boyle gives it that extra. There's so much about it. Like, the cast, I love everything about this movie.
We'll get into the cast a little bit. You mentioned your Sunshine Theory, which we haven't really talked about on the show. One thing that we do talk an awful lot about is the McAvoy turn, and that's James McAvoy going from the guy that did Wanted to now a guy that we really, really like.
I used to hate McAvoy, and then after Trance and Welcome to the Punch, like, and Filth, all in the same year, like, I love McAvoy.
The back-to-back Best Picture winner for Movies on Up.
Yeah, so, like, I love McAvoy. Channing Tatum did that. McAvoy was the third McAvoy turn, because Channing Tatum, hated Channing Tatum until 21 Jump Street, and then now I love Channing Tatum. Chris Evans was actually the first McAvoy turn. I hated him. He was the dude from Down Another Teen Movie. He was in Cellular, The Perfect Score.
Johnny Storm at that point.
Johnny Storm, who I thought he was okay as Johnny Storm, but I still didn't like him. And then I see him in this movie, and it was like, okay, I'm going to go back and rewatch everything I disliked him in. I'm going to go back and watch the stuff I skipped because he was in it. And since then, I've loved Chris Evans. Not the greatest actor in the world. In this, he's really, really good. Mace is a great character, and he plays it so well.
I actually think all the actors did what they were asked to do very well. I mean, Cillian Murphy gives a very Cillian Murphy performance in this movie. Mace is very much a bully, but he's still a guy that, like, you don't hate.
I think Mace brings this military precision. Yeah. Like, he comes off, he seems like he has military experience because he's very by the book. He's very straightforward. He's very procedural, and everything has a purpose and everything.
Hey, this might be an ugly thing to talk about, but this has got to happen.
And very decisive. Yeah. Like, oh, okay, you know, there's only one spacesuit.
Yeah.
But Kappa's got to go. Like, yeah, I'd like to be the one to live, but Kappa's more important. But just with a split second. And he was so good in that, as that. I think Troy Garrity as Harvey was so good at being unlikable. Corazon, Rose Byrne, Benedict Wong, I thought was really good as Trey.
Yeah, he didn't, like, have a lot to do,
but what he had to do, he was great. I fucked up. Yep. Like, he's the one that derails everything. You know, Cliff Curtis is just this guy who's, you think if things turn out different, he ends up being Pinbacker, almost.
Oh,
like,
for
and
sure.
It's like he's become obsessed with the sun, and just is Kaneda's dying? Is Kaneda's about to die? What do you see? What do you see? Like, he's almost jealous of him in that moment,
right,
because he's so close to the sun. And it's fascinating. The whole cast, I think, is so good. For being small parts, Michelle Yeoh, Corazon, when the you know, she's the botanist on there. Mm-hmm. It's her baby is this oxygen farm. And when it's burning up, like, you'd swear she's losing a child. And she's so good in that moment. And it's all just so good. And the deaths matter. And it's the characters matter. And, yeah, they don't all get along. Like, they're not
sure.
All, like,
it's not like the crew from The Martian where they all, like, legit love
each other. Yeah.
Right.
No, this is legit, like, you know, they're indifferent. You know, there are people that hate each other. There's mm-hmm. people that are indifferent to each other, but they know they have to work together. And they do.
Yeah, they do when they have to, and they certainly are able to, I guess, put aside enough of their differences. But it's unsurprising in one breath to say that all the deaths matter. Of course they do, because they're written well. What should come out of this episode is when Alex Garland is on, there are few people that are going to be able to write something that Dave and I are going to appreciate. Few people are going to be able to do that better than Alex Garland. So no matter what he does, Ex Machina was, I didn't need to know anything about the movie. All I needed to know was that, okay, Alex Garland wrote it. All right, I'll go ahead and take a look at it. He's adapting Annihilation from Jeff Vandermeer's book. But I don't need to see the cast where, you know, another director, maybe I do. But him as a storyteller, I'm on board with. But there's certainly enough star power in Annihilation. Natalie Portman's in there, Oscar Isaac, Tessa Thompson, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Benedict Wong is going to show up in this as well. So I am excited for Alex Garland stuff. He's now, instead of just being a writer who I'm pumped to see, based on Ex Machina, he's now a director that I'm interested in seeing too.
Yeah, and he's quickly become like, there are directors that I'll see anything they do. Like Edgar Wright is one, Matthew Vaughn is another one that comes to mind. Like, Garland has been that way for, if he wrote something, I'm going to see it. Now that he's directing his own stuff, I'm definitely going to see it. Because Ex Machina, I thought, was a fantastic directorial debut. And what he does well is he writes in a bottle very well. Because you look at 28 Days Later, you're looking at the main core is those 3 to 5 characters that you're with most of the time. And Sunshine, you have that crew of like 8 or so. Dread was a bottle movie, an action movie with your 2 main characters in one building, pretty much. So Ex Machina was 3 people, and he does that real well. So Annihilation's a little bit of a bigger scale for him, but I'm excited to see what he does. The book is different. It's a hard book to adapt, but if anybody can do it, I think it's going to be Garland.
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway. I mean, I think this might be, sometimes I think you have to go out of your way, especially when these guys are first starting out, to find guys that are doing different stuff. And he might be one that after Annihilation, maybe his name's a little bit bigger. And it's not as hard to find Alex Garland stories or not as, I think he's doing a TV show. He's gotten the works now as well. But certainly it's worth your time to go back. If you like 28 Days Later and somehow have missed Sunshine, I think you'd be really doing yourself a solid by going back and watching,
and you know,
that.
He's one of those that even if he doesn't blow up, he isn't getting offered like superhero movies or franchises, that's fine.
He doesn't need
it's
the budget.
It's going to do well enough yeah. that he's going to be able to make another movie. So awesome. Like, I'll see anything he does.
Garland was nominated in 2014 for Best Original Screenplay for Ex Machina. Next week, we're going to run down not only the nominees for Best Original Screenplay, but also kind of some handpicked categories that we like. We'll give you our Oscar preview. I'm not guaranteeing it's going to help you win your Oscar pool, but it might at least give you an idea of who we think might win the big ones, and to find out what the big ones are, and more importantly, who the winners are.
And our opinions, more importantly.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a heavy dose of that.
Criticism this year, much less than in past years. But we still have them.
Snarky criticisms, basically. Yeah. To find out what those criticisms are and who the winners and the losers are, come back next week. But until then.